Chair of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. This morning we have two petitions for rule adoption. I'll call them in the numerical order. The first is 6-02 in the matter of the petition to amend Wisconsin Statutes 809-19-3. The presenter is Constance Chesnick, attorney with the Department of Workforce Development. Ms. Chesnick.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Constance Chesnick, and I'm an attorney in the Department of Workforce Development. Our department is responsible for the administration of the child support program in Wisconsin, and I'm here today to speak on support of Rules Petition 0602, which would amend Section 809-19, Paragraph 3, to clarify that it is permissible for the state to file a statement advising the court that no brief will be filed in cases where the state has no interest in the issue being appealed. I understand that the Court of Appeals has filed a friendly amendment to the rules petition with some minor modifications to reflect a change proposed by the appellate practice section of the state bar. The department supports that amendment with those modifications. I realize that the court's time is valuable, so I will just take a moment to briefly explain the rationale for the petition. The state is a real party in interest under Section 767.075 in family actions only for the purpose of establishing paternity and establishing and enforcing child support orders. Our program is 66% federally funded, and with respect to legal representation, that funding is limited to representation on child support and paternity-related issues. Our attorneys represent the state and not the individual litigants. The state delegates this authority to represent the state to attorneys in each of our 71 county agencies and 3 tribal child support agencies. I believe that this rule change is necessary because it improves the rules of appellate procedure, formalizes a practice which is not currently contemplated by the rules of appellate procedure, and saves time and money for everyone. That concludes my presentation, unless you have other issues you'd like me to address. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. If matters arise on other appearances, we'll call you back. Thank you. I have 2 appearances, Steve Levine, President of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and Kenneth L. Lund, counsel. Mr. Levine. We have your letter on file. And
thank you. Actually, I'll be very brief just to say that the bar voted unanimously to support the petition with the amendment as proposed by the suggested by the appellate section. I don't think there's any controversy about that. If you do have any question, Mr. Lund is here from the appellate section to answer any technical questions.
And I gather that you accept the language, in fact, it may have been your language, within the time limits for filing a respondent's brief, a party was designated as a respondent. That's okay with you. Okay. Any questions for Ms. Levine? Thank you, Ms. Levine.
Thank you.
There's no
Mr. Lund? Any questions?
My only question, there's no opposition to this.
Right. No, this is a formal... This is a formal amendment, and we attempted in various correspondence to determine whether or not this could not be handled internally by an internal operating procedure rather than a rule, and the Court of Appeals responded to Ms. Rich's letter saying better to have a rule. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Are there any other appearances on 0602 in the matter of the petition to amend 809-19-3? Hearing none, the hearing on this petition is closed. The court will deal with it in open session after we hear the next petition. I'll call 0605 in the matter of the petition for adoption of a procedure to suspend or deny the license to practice law of a person certified as delinquent in the payment of Wisconsin state taxes. The presenter is Dana J. Erlinson, Chief Legal Counsel, Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. I have with me today Diane Hart, our Division Administrator of the Income, Sales and Excise Tax Division, as well as Department Revenue staff from our Legal and Compliance sections, in case questions arise that I am not able to answer. Our goal with this petition is to treat all Wisconsin professionals alike when it comes to delinquent taxes. This currently is not the case. All state licensed professionals in Wisconsin are currently subject to certain consequences if they're able to pay their taxes and refuse to do so, namely that their licenses may be subject to suspension or denial by their licensing agency. This is true of everyone but attorneys. It is true of Wisconsin physicians, Wisconsin nurses, teachers, brokers, CPAs. Our profession is the last profession excluded.
How many are of these other professions, if you know, lose their license or have to appear each year? Do you know that?
We don't keep it by profession, but since in the last 10 years since we adopted these rules, we have certified approximately 1% of the licenses, all licenses issued in the last 10 years or renewed in the last 10 years. So it's a very rare circumstance for us.
At the time the license would be lost to the attorney, I'm assuming that all legal appeals have been taken, that if there's an argument over it. So this is where you have a judgment.
Yes, there must be a full and final disposition of the tax liability before we would even proceed to the next levels of due process. We have some additional levels before we certify the attorney's delinquency to this court. The attorney may request a hearing with our agency to review whether there's any defenses or mitigating factors that have been neglected and that should be considered before certifying to the court.
Mr. Owens, the
court itself may consider it.
How do you see this fitting with our Office of Lawyer Regulation? Would there be some kind of cooperative effort between both agencies?
Well, we have always cooperated with the Office of Lawyer Regulation when in submitting our cases for non-filing, for discipline. And so we would certainly seek their input on it, but we would be certifying these cases to the court for its action, which could be achieved, as I understand it, with a referee or special master, if the court chose.
I understand the proposal is that there would be an order to show cause issued by this court. Is that correct?
If the attorney chose to challenge it at this point, they could have an order to show cause opportunity before this court or its designee.
Do you see this in any way impinging upon the authority of this court to control who practices law in Wisconsin?
No, I do not, Your Honor, because we would simply be certifying and telling you that this attorney is tax delinquent. It would be up to this court to determine whether suspension is appropriate, and if so, for what period of time.
Following up on Justice Crooks's questions, I recognize that petition is drafted following the child support petition, where a similar procedure was done. That also ran into some question when it was presented to this court. And one of the prime differences between the Department of Revenue and the child support is that federal regulations and law had a significant impact unless we did something similar to that. We don't have that problem here. And although it was drafted similarly, perhaps it should be redrafted to say that if there is a certification under your procedures, which do give opportunity for notice and hearing, et cetera, if there is a certification, that it go to the OLR as a comparable to a complaint or grievance, and then it be treated that way, and therefore that the OLR make the initial determinations whether this is something that should go to the court or not, rather than coming directly to the court.
I personally have no problem with that, Your Honor. When we first drafted this rule, we sought guidance from OLR and from this court's commissioners, and it was at their suggestion that we modeled our rule on the DWD rule.
And that's a good idea, because that was a successful petition. So that looked good, I would think. But we got some differences, and we have not had, as far as I know, any child support cases, as best I can know, that came up through us directly. This might raise more issues than the other. I don't know. And we got a letter from a lawyer who apparently does a lot of state public defender work and says past years the public defender's office didn't pay for the last, I've forgotten the number of months, 2, 3, 4 months, because they ran out of money, so they waited until July and they then paid old bills. Well, you know, that means that after a while, it's not 2, 3, 4 months, it's 6 months that they can't pay because they don't have enough money. So you've got lawyers who are owed 20, 40, something on the thousands of dollars, which they don't collect, and therefore may have financial difficulties themselves. So it may be that this may create a larger problem, and the court really is not set up for fact-finding and that kind of hearing. And so Justice Crooks's questions brought to mind whether or not there's a way of doing this that might be simpler.
Well, there's two things I want to address. One is that I certainly have no objection to an amendment. I mean, I think this court knows best how to handle disciplinary cases mm-hmm. that come before it. If that is the preferred procedure, I think we would certainly agree to it. And we could present the court with a redraft in that regard. I want to address the inability to pay question that was raised by the attorney, because I want to clarify when we use certifications. There are two circumstances in which we would not use certifications. One is where there is an inability to pay. Certification is useless to us if there's an mm-hmm. inability to pay. Additionally, if there's equitable factors that may mitigate against certification, mm-hmm. perhaps the attorney has a medical disability or other circumstances, mm-hmm. the kind of circumstances that this court considers every day in determining whether to impose discipline, we would not certify in that case. Mm-hmm. And certainly in a case, to me, a case where the state, where the attorney can't pay because the state hasn't paid it, that to me shows both inability to pay and an equitable circumstance that doesn't merit certification.
I have another question, if I may, and that is that the state bar would be required to release Social Security numbers to you. Now, my memory is just not good enough to know whether that was done in the child support issue. But that raises a basic problem, which I really have not thought through, as to whether that would violate any privacy rules, or federal or state, and a multitude of other things. It seems to me you ought to be able to figure out who's a lawyer, because as I remember the form, there's a box that said, what is your profession?
Your Honor, I don't believe there would be any problem with sharing Social Security numbers with us. We are bound by a host of federal and state rules that strictly govern our ability to use and disclose Social Security numbers. Our intention would be to enter, as we are authorized to do, to enter into a memorandum of understanding with the state bar, just as DWD did. Which would cover the privacy and use of Social Security numbers. For our purposes, they would primarily be used for identification to match up the attorneys with taxpayers.
The Chief asked you a question early on about the number of people who might be affected by this. And I didn't quite understand your answer, something about 1%. Could you clarify that, please?
Since 1996, I believe, when this program first started, there have been, as I understand it, over 700,000 licenses issued or renewed in the state of Wisconsin. We have certified less than 1% of that amount to
at
the regulatory agencies.
People.
Yes. And remember, we certify them to the regulatory agencies. The regulatory agencies then choose whether or not to take disciplinary action or as dictated by their own rules.
So can you focus on the number of attorneys who you think would be affected by this rule?
Well, unfortunately, we don't keep statistics by profession, but I have done an informal survey of our compliance people. They tell me that currently in collections they believe we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 100 attorneys. That is simply 40 to 100 attorneys who owe taxes for a variety of reasons, some of who are in the process of entering into payment agreements with us. It would be a very small percentage of that who we might consider certification for.
What are the taxes that would trigger this mechanism?
Income tax, sales tax, and withholding tax, primarily.
So property taxes would not be affected?
No.
So if someone didn't have a whole lot of money, they might not pay their property taxes in order to pay the income or sales tax. Is that possible?
It may be possible. I don't know.
Why should property taxes not be affected?
Because the department does not track statewide compliance with property tax. That's done on a local basis. Each municipality keeps track of that. And the legislature determined, for whatever reason, that that was not part of this statute.
Counselor, if you don't certify when there's a medical disability, you don't certify when there's no ability to pay, can you give me a scenario of when you would certify? So someone's filed a return, so they're not in that category. Give me a fact set of
when. Let me give you an example. We have attorneys who are tax protesters. They have determined that it is helpful to pay their, to file their taxes to at least stay out of jail, mm-hmm. but they are determined not to pay them because that would represent some sort of yielding of their principles, so they don't pay.
Okay, give me another example aside from that.
Another example, we have attorneys who simply don't wish to pay. They would rather send their money anywhere but the Department of Revenue.
Well, what's your interest rate?
Our interest rate is dictated by statute.
What is it?
It is 9% on refunds and 12% on assessments.
Mm-hmm. That might be cheaper than using a credit card. Mm-hmm. Paying.
Yes.
And paying 18%.
Yes.
Or maybe for some people going to one of these auto title loan places. So.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've indicated that since 1996, over 700,000 licenses have been extended or renewed, and that you've certified about 1%.
Less than 1%.
Less than 1%. Okay. How many, doctors that you've certified have lost their license because of non-payment?
As I said, we don't keep statistics for that, but for actual suspensions or loss of licenses, only the certifications. And we don't keep them by professions. Speaking just anecdotally, it's my understanding that physicians tend to be among the more responsible professions currently, and that it's very rare that we end up certifying them.
How many dentists have been suspended because of that?
Well, now we're going beyond my anecdotal knowledge.
Okay. So the procedure, let's say, with the doctors or the dentist examining board must be different than the procedure you're suggesting here. There must be, once you certify, there must be no involvement of your department because you have no knowledge. I mean, you certify and then that's it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you have no knowledge of if any of these less than 1% have ever been subject to any suspension of their license.
That's not strictly true, Your Honor. I mean, informally, we know because generally after we certify these, most of them come back to us with payments and seek reinstatement. And when we get such payments, we make a same-day turnaround to their licensing agency.
So anecdotally, can you give me an idea then, anecdotally, how many professionals have been suspended, their professional license has been suspended as a result of your certification?
I think the exact number of our certifications was approximately 5,000 mm-hmm. or so, 4,500, 5,000, somewhere.
So I'm not talking about payments now that you get in. I'm talking about professional boards suspending their licensees because as a result of your certification. That's what I'm looking for.
One moment, Your Honor. Unfortunately, I can't, Your Honor. We don't get that kind of feedback necessarily from the agencies. Our feedback is from the taxpayer.
Justice Rogensack asked you a question about what kind of action would you take against, or what kind of activity would precipitate action by your department. You mentioned tax protesters. What about this? Let's say there was an attorney who didn't file a state income tax for 1985 until 1987, so he was late. And then he filed his 1986 return again 2 years late. And he didn't file any income taxes, state income taxes, for 3 years, 1987 to 1990. Would that be the kind of activity without more information that you would likely certify?
You mentioned only non-filing. You didn't mention whether or not the attorney had eventually paid. As soon as the attorney pays, our interest in certification would evaporate.
Non-filing is a different kind of conduct, too, correct? We already have a rule that deals with non-filing.
Yes, that's correct, Justice Rogensack. And in fact, the court to date has only disciplined in cases where non-filing was involved.
Right.
Occasionally, there have been cases involving both non-filing and non-payment, but never non-payment alone. It has been suggested that your rules may cover non-payment alone. That has not been cleared to the department. And when we sought guidance from, as I said, the commissioners in OLR, they suggested that a separate rule was appropriate for this sort of conduct.
You suggested, counsel, that my statement of facts needed a bit more because you didn't know whether or not there was payment. Let's say there was failure to pay taxes. Is that the kind of situation that you would certify?
No, Your Honor, because if there have to be a number of other preconditions first. First, we have to bill them, and they have to fail to pay the bill. And we have to contact them and try and work out payment arrangements. Voluntary payment arrangements are by far our number one way of collecting.
And if he didn't respond to 3 written notices from the Department of Revenue regarding your tax liability and failure to file tax returns, what would you do then?
Well, then we would initiate collection efforts, Your Honor. And if collection efforts were not fruitful, then we would look at potentially certifying them. We would, again, try and contact them because we are interested in ability to pay. If there's any hint of inability to pay, then we want to know about that.
Fair enough. That's a good response. My inquiry really, and I, as you can tell, I'm reading from a per curiam opinion in a disciplinary matter. And I wonder, you know, since we discipline these folks for that kind of activity and have in the past, why do we need this new procedure? Why should we take a different avenue than the avenue that already exists and that we have many cases regarding tax non-payment or non-filing?
Because I think it's important to treat all Wisconsin taxpayers alike.
Well, that's why I ask whether or not any profession has ever suspended or taken away the license as a result of your certification. And we have. We've got cases that do that. And so I want to know what are the consequences to these other professionals for non-payment of taxes.
I know that there are suspensions, Your Honor. I know that because other taxpayers contact us to pay and to release the suspension of their license. But because those agencies are not required to and do not give us statistics on how many that they suspend, I cannot tell you how many suspend. I could not tell you how many this court would choose to suspend if we certified to it. That decision is ultimately the regulatory agencies.
The licenses that you're talking about here, are these all state licenses?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
So in other words, if someone had a local license, you wouldn't be interested in that.
We're not authorized by statute to look into that, Your Honor. Similarly with federal licenses, a commercial truck driver, we don't, you know, that's not issued by the state. That's not something that we would deal with.
So you're not interested in all licenses, and you're not interested in all taxes.
Well,
but
we
you
are
want
interested.
To treat everybody the same.
We are interested in all state licenses, as the legislature authorized us to do so. If the legislature would authorize us to look after local licenses, the department, of course, would respond to that. But we are bound by the constraints of our statute.
Do you look at a chauffeur's license issued by the Department of Transportation in Wisconsin?
I think so, Your Honor. I'll have someone check the list. As I said, if it's a state-issued occupational license, it is covered on our list.
But not personal licenses like driver's licenses. That's too diffuse because there's not...
driver's licenses are not considered occupational licenses issued by the state. So, no, those are not covered.
Are there any other questions?
Chief,
Justice
Carter. I hate to be obtuse, but could you kind of walk very simply through the process leading up to a certification?
I'd be happy to, Justice Prosser. First, it's not enough just to, like, forget to put your check in with your April 15th tax return. You have to wait. The department actually has to assess or bill you. And then if there's some dispute when you get that assessment or bill, then there has to be that full and final disposition, which may come all the way up through the courts. Once you have that full and final disposition, then you have to fail to pay, and we have to contact you and talk to you, or you have to ignore several attempts to contact you. Well, we try and work out some voluntary payment arrangement, and that is by far our preference because it's the most efficient way to get money from taxpayers. If that doesn't work, then we'll try collection efforts. And if that doesn't work, then we'll consider certification. And at all times, of course, we want to know if the taxpayer tells us that they're not paying, that they won't pay, we want to know why. If inability to pay is a factor, if there are equitable circumstances, we seek that out. We ask them about this. And so once we – but let's say that the taxpayer simply says, I don't want to pay you. Don't call me. Don't bother me. I have better things to spend my money on. At that point, and they haven't indicated – we know they're not in bankruptcy. As far as we know, there's no mitigating circumstances. We then send them a notice saying that we intend to certify – that they are tax delinquent to the Supreme Court or to their licensing agency, and that if they wish to dispute the certification, that it's appropriate, they can have an administrative hearing with us. If they're not satisfied with the results of the administrative hearing, they can take that up through the courts. If, when that is resolved, it is resolved in favor of the department, only then does the department certify the license to the regulatory agency, or in this case, the Supreme Court.
And could you clarify once more whether there is a distinction between owing taxes and filing taxes?
Yes, there is an important distinction, Your Honor. And one of the things that concerned us looking at it was that, for example, under Wisconsin statutes, it is a crime not to file, or can be potentially a crime, not to file your taxes. So that makes it a more serious violation than nonpayment, which by state law is not necessarily criminal conduct. And there's no criminal statute that would cover that.
You familiar with the Van Susteren case, which was a judicial discipline case on failing to file?
I'm familiar, Your Honor. Not filing is often combined with nonpayment, and that one of the things I wanted to just briefly address that I believe Attorney Scheinman brought up is why is the Department of Revenue special? Because this is beyond an ordinary debt. Tax liabilities are not an ordinary debt. They are given special preferences by collection statutes and by the legislature because our taxes support the state of Wisconsin, which issued all of our license to begin with. They support our judicial system. They support services, libraries, roads, for all our taxpayers. So that's why we have preferred treatment in bankruptcy and other situations.
So when Attorney Scheidemann, this is on his third point, second page of his letter, says that there's no sound public policy advanced by your agency that would mandate that you should be a preferred creditor, that is, you're saying that is inaccurate because you are a preferred
creditor.
Yes, I am,
Your Honor.
If there are no further questions.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rawlinson. We have two other appearances, Mr. Levine, President of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and Judge Charles Dykeman appearing in his own behalf. Are there any other appearances on this issue? All right, we'll hear from you, Mr. Levine.
If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Levine. I'm president of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and I'm here today to present the State Bar's view with regard to the Department of Revenue's petition. At its meeting in September, the State Bar Board of Governors voted to oppose the petition of the Department of Revenue. This was after the department appeared at the bar's September meeting, both with written materials and representatives made a very persuasive presentation to the board. But even after that presentation, the board decided to oppose this petition, I think, on two primary bases. Not on the merits of the petition itself. No one is here defending lawyers who intentionally choose not to pay their state income taxes. The bar's opposition was not on that basis at all. The bar's opposition, I think, was on two principles. First of all, that the regulation of lawyers in this state and the determination of what is professional misconduct is the province of this court rather than the legislature. And this court had set out not only the rules of professional conduct, but the procedures for enforcing those rules.
Now, that's correct, but aren't they asking for a shared responsibility? In other words, I listened to the presentation, I read the material. It seems to me that the most egregious would be the most egregious offenders, and then it would be solely up to the OLR and the Supreme Court whether they would be disciplined. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that, Your Honor, is, as you mentioned, there's already the OLR that's in place. This court has already determined, as Justice Bradley.
But isn't the OLR, they look at non-filing different than delinquency. Are you saying that they also look at delinquency?
OLR?
Yes.
There would be no way right now for OLR to find that out unless.
I'm not familiar with any, quote, pure delinquency. I think that they have dealt primarily, if not always, with non-filing. And this is a little different situation. In other words, you talked about the province of this court, but it's also, do you think there should not be a shared responsibility in this particular area?
Well, in this case, I think we have a situation where the court was actually out ahead of the legislature in this area. As Justice Bradley referred to before, this court, you know, long ago determined that it was unprofessional conduct for someone not to file their income taxes.
I understand the not filing. We're talking about delinquency, not non-payment. For whatever, there were some examples given. I just don't want to pay. I'm never going to pay. And particularly, what about payment of employer withholding tax? That affects other people. Just asking about that one issue.
It does, but again, the bar's primary opposition to the Department of Revenue's petition is that there's already an enforcement mechanism in place that this court can take into consideration. If, you know, whatever offense is included under the Department of Revenue's petition right now, the Department of Revenue, under current procedures, can go to OLR and say a lawyer is either delinquent or a lawyer hasn't filed taxes, and go through the current procedure that the court has already mandated.
Well, isn't there a difference between non-filing and not paying? I think that's what, as I listen to the DOR, they're concerned about the non-payment. Do you know of any case that this court has handled? We've had the Van Susteren case. We just had the Nugent, other cases. Do you know of any case where it's been a delinquency matter that this court has ever taken the license or even had a hearing on?
I don't think one has come up yet, Your Honor.
No.
If I just may, for clarification, my recollection of the Van Susteren case was that it's not that he didn't always pay. It's just that he always paid very, very late, and it was the untimely filing that did.
Filing. He always paid because it was withheld or something.
It was,
yeah. But it was the untimeliness repeatedly that was a part of it, at least.
But
The delinquency.
But it was primarily a, quote, filing case. I'm just asking these questions because realizing that the bar is regulated by this court, the argument is made, well, are we special? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that, certainly, and the Board of Governors certainly wasn't saying that.
Well, I noticed the vote was 30 to 11, so it wasn't. There was a significant, I would say obviously you had a good discussion and not everyone agreed.
What provision of the SCR do you think this falls under?
Why did I know you were going to ask me that, Your Honor?
20:8-4.
Right. I think there are a couple letters that were filed with the court that cite that provision and also cite the court's precedent where the court has already found a violation of the Code of Professional Conduct. I guess when it comes down to, in a nutshell, what the buyer is saying is there are already procedures in place. The court has already determined on the merits that this kind of conduct violates the Code of Professional Responsibility. There are already procedures in place. If the Department of Revenue comes into difficult cases of lawyers who will not file or are constantly late in filing their income tax, the Department can file the current procedures that are on file and achieve the same result as what this petition is proposing. The Department would merely go to the OLR, file a complaint, and then the procedures that are in place right now for this and for every other kind of professional misconduct would apply. The problem is, as you cited before, Chief Justice Abrahamson, you have child support now. Well, that was federally mandated. Now you have the Department of Revenue for income tax violations. In a couple of years, it might be something else. And a couple of years later, it might be something else. So there's a proliferation of different procedures. The court already has a single procedure and a single way of enforcing the Code of Professional Responsibility in place. The buyer's position is not in opposition to the merits of the department's petition, but in opposition based on the fact that there's already a method for enforcement in place, and there's no need to duplicate that or have a proliferation of different enforcement mechanisms.
Now, Mr. Levine, do you see any difference? And I might agree with what you're saying on individual income tax. Do you see any difference in sales, use, or employer withholding? If the lawyer is in business for him or herself, that's what I'm talking about, where it could, I'm not sure whether there is such a thing, but do you see any difference between the individual income tax and a sales or and a employer withholding? Are they all the same?
I don't think that issue came up in the Board of Governors discussion. As far as my own personal feeling, I think one violation is as bad as the other, as you mentioned. But both of those, or whatever type of violation you're dealing with, can be dealt with under current court procedures. And as I said, the court was ahead of the legislature in this area. And I think the bar's fear is that not only this petition, but future petitions are going to lead to a proliferation of different types of procedures where there's one unified procedure right now that already can handle this problem.
So, suppose that instead of this procedure with OL, with an order to show cause, and I did not look at the new Ethics 2000 proposal to see if it's comparable provision about misconduct. That's the general thing. that a comment was made there that with reference to the statute and that the Department of Revenue should take the matter to the OLR that you wouldn't object to.
I don't see any problem with that at all, whether it's the Department of Revenue or any other state department.
Okay. All right.
Well, isn't there a potential problem for the attorney that the attorney is going to be assessed costs for that now? In other words, the attorney is going to have to finance his own prosecution.
I think that might occur in either case, though, under either procedure.
Only if they contest it.
Counsel, are you familiar what other states have done with regard to a request like this, if such a request exists in those states?
I don't know if a similar petition has been presented to courts in other states. Maybe the attorneys for the Department of Revenue could inform the court on that. I'm not aware of it.
Do you know, and perhaps you're not the person to ask, I had pulled the Van Susteren opinion, and among other things, that is failure to finally close estates and other stuff like this. With regard to taxes, his discipline was based on his failure to timely file state income and corporate franchise tax returns. So it's failure to timely file state income and corporate franchise tax returns. Do you know, is the request here today, is it your understanding that that covers corporate franchise tax returns also?
I think it's just, as the attorney for the department said, I think it's just sales tax and Social Security and Medicare taxes.
We can ask Ms. Erlinson that. Okay.
One final question. I'm looking through my child support file of 2001 when we did this. My recollection is that if we didn't do this child support collection, this came from the feds, the directive from the feds, that we stand to lose money. And I don't want to exaggerate, but in order for me to have voted for this, it would have required lots of money. Do you recall how much we were going to lose in federal aids, if my recollection is correct, if we didn't enact this?
I don't know, Your Honor. I wasn't familiar with that proceeding when it occurred.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Judge Dykeman.
My name is Charles Dykeman. I live in Monona, Wisconsin. I'm a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and I appear in that capacity. I have obtained the information that I presently have from the Department of Revenue petition, the Wisconsin Law Journal's reports, Section 73.0301 statutes, and a couple of cases that I have reviewed. I have two reasons why I oppose this petition. The first of these is a suspicion of rules designed to punish debtors by removing their ability to earn. I think this is counterintuitive, and I think that where it hits is usually with the people that are least able to pay debts and usually least able to defend themselves. This is not a debtor's prison situation, of course, but it uses the same rationale. You either pay or you forfeit your ability to pay. I, too, question the percentage of lawyers who, first of all, don't pay their income taxes. I know of one, but that is about it.
Judge Dykeman, just want to interrupt. Since you talked about income tax, I asked Mr. Levine about sales and use and employer withholding. Do you consider those different than income, or is that all in the same basket?
Well, I'm not sure that the person who gets into a sales tax problem is doing so in a capacity as an attorney. I think at that point they're in business usually, and I haven't really looked at that because I'm focusing on attorneys for this presentation. So I would say that if you're in business, why, you're not a lawyer, and then you're going to have to defend against the DOR in that way.
Well, what about, and I, like you, practice law. You had to, you're an employer. You have five or six secretaries, whatever, bookkeeper. What about employer withholding, where you're to withhold their taxes, you know, that you would be paying? Do you see that differently than income tax?
I believe that at least federally, the failure to withhold and pay, I guess I'm not familiar federally with what the rule is, but I think there are criminal sanctions for that. And indeed, if the purpose is to get some taxes paid, rather than going through a rather convoluted procedure, absent Eighth Amendment problems, the solution, I think, for the DOR is to petition the legislature to change the law and make it a crime not to pay your income taxes. Then you've got a pretty good handle, I think, as an agency, and you can wield a lot more power. I think people are a little more worried about the end result when they're facing a prison term. At any rate, if there's less than 1% of people, and we don't know about attorneys, that are actually prosecuted under this rule, that's not a great many lawyers, and I wonder whether this procedure, which is somewhat time consuming and will take up the time of this court. The way it's drafted, it will indeed be this court that does the work on it, because there's no reference to OLR. But my conclusion on this is that this is the equivalent to using a howitzer to kill an ant. The second reason that I have to oppose this rule is that Section 73.0301 is liberally spread with the parenthetical, if the Supreme Court agrees. And I assume that adopting this rule would be an agreement with the statute. If that is the case, the statute requires the Supreme Court to do certain things, and in particular, it brings the Supreme Court into the statute, which although it does have some special requirements for lawyers, does not when it comes to the two requirements for coming under the statute, and that is the identity of the debtor and the liability. And if those two are met, there are no equitable considerations that are available, at least under the statute, and query whether that would not be true of this court also. It goes beyond then the rule as it applies, as this rule, this proposed rule applies, and sets up what perhaps is a conflict and a separation of powers issue. The statute does... Yes.
Excellency. Could you give a hypothetical to flesh out what you're just saying?
Yes. A hypothetical would be the Department of Revenue appearing either before this court, if that is how this is to be accomplished. Now, the court, I've listened to the previous questions, and the court has suggested that perhaps OLR might have a place in here, and I do not see that in 73.0301. And thus, I see the Department of Revenue taking a position with any particular attorney that the only issues are identification and liability. And they will say, we have already determined the liability, and all we have to determine is if Charles Dyckman, you are the Charles Dyckman that owes the tax, and if you are, that will be the end of the discussion. Now, this does not permit a situation where perhaps an attorney who has married someone who until the marriage is along for, say, several years, doesn't discover that he or she has married a deadbeat, and that this person has indeed incurred liabilities, and the attorney has, because the spouse has always taken care of taxes, has signed the tax return and thus is liable. And equitably speaking, it might be unfair, since the spouse is probably in South America, to require the attorney spouse, or the ex-spouse attorney, to pay the taxes when the attorney spouse has always paid his or her share of the taxes and is now being asked to pay the share of the spouse who managed to figure out a way not to pay the taxes. That, I think, is an equitable consideration. The Department of Revenue might say, well, we certainly wouldn't ask that person to pay taxes, but I am not altogether certain that that wouldn't happen. At least that would be my scenario for that.
Well, Mr. Judge Dyckman, seems to me that the legislature has been careful, although I'm sure that there might be better ways of drafting all this. Careful to say we're not having a yanking of the license, and we're not even telling the Supreme Court how to do it necessarily. But this may be viewed as a request for the court to consider doing something about attorneys who failed to pay taxes. And although the court has taken a position, as I understand it, in past cases, that the qualifications for attorneys and the grounds for discipline are within the court's purview, and perhaps even exclusively within the court's purview, that the general rule is, even in exclusive powers, the court is amenable to listening to the legislature, taking that into account, and to the extent it can, giving comedy to the legislative wishes. As a general principle, I think you're nodding in agreement. I don't think I've said anything that's can't be accepted. So why in this situation we have the legislature saying payment of taxes is important to all of us, one way of getting payment is through the licensing system. So court, think about doing something along these lines. Why shouldn't we do that? Now, I'm not dealing with the particulars of this petition, but as a general principle.
Well, as a general precept, I think that the Supreme Court certainly has the ability to handle whatever it deems proper with the licenses of attorneys. And although there, I believe that there may well be some amount of comedy and some exceptions, I guess if this were a petition that were brought about by the state bar, I might feel differently about it. But it is not, and the request is of the Supreme Court to essentially say yes. And I see that the statute is sprinkled pretty liberally with if the Supreme Court agrees, followed by the word shall. And at least as I understand the word shall, it means that once the agreement is made, here's how it has to be done. And I believe that at least suggests a problem with the separation of powers. And it suggests to me that what has been proposed by the Department of Revenue is not what the statute requires.
Because the Supreme Court doesn't have to agree with every single provision, and it can provide its own way of handling licensing of lawyers under its own procedure, yet within the general public policy set forth by the legislature. It seems to me that's what the legislature intended and provided for in the, as you put it, sprinkling of if the Supreme Court agrees.
Well, that, I agree with that, but I do not agree with the same sprinkling of the word shall.
Well, we didn't do the sprinkling and neither did you, Judge.
and that's the problem I see with it, is that that sprinkling was done by the legislature. And they at least could be viewed as telling the Supreme Court what it has to do, and I at least feel that that goes a little far. Finally, I think I've given the example of the ex-spouse. I think that that attorneys may well be different, and certainly this proposed rule and the statute treats attorneys differently. But I think that that attorneys are different. If a doctor's license is removed, I have seen instances where that doctor merely moves to the usual state is California and sets up practice out there because apparently doctors are more needed, if that's the term, than attorneys. But attorneys are not trained to go out and find a job. I guess you couldn't even be a used car salesman because you have to have a license for that. But attorneys are not necessarily trained to do a whole lot of other work, and I think that it may well be counterproductive were this rule to be adopted. Accordingly, I would ask the court to just say no. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Dankman. Attorney Thomas Basting asked to appear. Mr. Basting.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing me to speak very briefly to you this morning. In opposition to this petition, I appear today on my own behalf personally as a lawyer in the state who has dealt with prosecuting on behalf of OLR and has dealt with ethics issues for over 40 years now, I guess, in Wisconsin. My principal opposition to this petition is, first of all, that I believe it's covered under the current rules. And I understand from Justice Wilcox's question as to, well, can you cite any cases to us where we have sanctioned a lawyer for failure to pay his taxes? The answer to that question is no. There are a number of cases that Mr. Schneidman pointed out in his letter to this court where lawyers have been sanctioned for failure to file. And the Van Susteren, which was a judicial commission case that has already been referred to. But in my opinion, that does not mean that a lawyer's willful failure to pay the taxes that are the subject matter of this petition is not covered under the current rule. 8.4F, I believe, is the rule that states that it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to fail to follow a statute, a case of this court, and so forth.
Yeah, but it has an ending to it that, and I don't know how this has been read, but it says, violate a statute, Supreme Court rule, Supreme Court order, or Supreme Court decision regulating the conduct of lawyers. And I don't know if that clause regulating the conduct of lawyers refers to everything or just the last.
I would submit it only refers to the last because there aren't very many statutes regulating the conduct of lawyers.
That's why I raised
that
issue.
Rules.
Now, in the Ethics 2000, is this provision that stays the same?
Yes. To my recollection, it does stay the same, and it's not fleshed out to include failure to pay taxes. My point
Should
is...
Should it be, or might it be?
Pardon me?
Might it be fleshed out to say, under this 73, Section 73, blah, 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 the Supreme Court calls attention to the OLR that...
I think
violation might be.
It very well could be, and the court has the opportunity to yet do that with the new ethics rules.
Okay.
My point is that I think currently, if the Department of Revenue went to OLR and said, we have a lawyer here who owes these income taxes, sales taxes, whatever they are.
Can I just stop you there? Because do you see a difference between the sales and employer withholding and income tax?
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
No. I think that might be something for this court to determine if a rule violation is brought before this court. But what we're talking about, Justice Wilcox, is we're at a point in time where all the appeals have been taken care of. Everything is done. The only issue is payment.
Payment. Well, and this is what I want someone to answer for me, is that my reason for distinguishing those is that when you are an employer, as I would try to use my own law firm, I was the employer withholding taxes and failed to pay them for somebody else, is that you see no difference between that and your own taxes.
I don't. I think if your conduct has an adverse effect on other people, it's probably more serious, which can be reflected in the sanction that may be imposed by this court, depending on how egregious this conduct was. But if the Department of Revenue now, as I said, had such a lawyer and went to OLR and said, we're filing a complaint, OLR, I believe, could file under 8.4F and proceed according to the regular procedures that are set forth in the rules now. My second point is this, and this hasn't been touched on, and that is it's been touched on briefly with the separation of powers argument. But lawyers are in a unique position here because they represent people before the Department of Revenue. They represent clients before the Department of Revenue. Now, I'm not suggesting, and I'd be the last person to suggest, that the Department of Revenue might engage in some mischief here. But if lawyers who have a dispute with the Department of Revenue themselves are representing clients in front of the Department of Revenue, there could be a potential chilling effect here where the Department of Revenue has some discretion lodged in it, as they do here, to decide which lawyers they're going to certify to have their license taken away and which lawyers they're not going to certify. Something that I think bears some consideration in thinking about whether this court should say we're going to give away some of our discretion in determining whether lawyers should be sanctioned for certain conduct. And I think this type of conduct should stay with the court under the Supreme Court rules and under OLR, as opposed to giving the discretion to anybody else. And that it would be more appropriate to do it within the rules, the Supreme Court rules in Chapter 20, than in this petition as it currently exists. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Basting. Does anyone else wish to appear on this rule? Ms. Erlandson, do you wish to add something? Yeah, please come to the microphone, because you're being recorded.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'll try to speak directly into the microphone. I did hear a few questions that I thought I might potentially shed some light on. Addressing Justice Wilcox's concern about, and actually Justice Bradley talked about corporate franchise tax, sales tax, withholding tax. Are they distinct from income tax? Yes, in some ways. Most of the cases we deal with are failure to pay income tax. Sales, withholding, and corporate franchise may be different if there's a corporation involved. In that case, we can only reach someone who's been established by litigation or otherwise as the responsible person for paying those taxes. And that is also true to some degree. Judge Dykeman mentioned his concern about the spouse and spousal liability. We have a legal doctrine in tax law called the good faith spouse doctrine, where if a spouse in good faith is unaware of what's being done with the taxes, that is a complete defense to liability, not just an equitable factor that can be considered later on. Justice Bradley also inquired what other states do, and unfortunately, because there's 49 others and I didn't have time to go through all the statutes and Supreme Court rules, I can only address a few that I'm aware of. Oklahoma and Minnesota in particular have very similar statutes to ours, in which they specifically address that all licensed professionals, including the name attorneys as part of the professions, may have their license subject to disciplinary consequences upon certification or information from the Department of Revenue in their states to the Supreme Court. Those statutes are relatively new. In fact, almost all of these licensing statutes that link licensing to payment of state taxes were adopted in the last 10 years. Other states have similar statutes that don't expressly mention attorneys but cover all professions. That includes Massachusetts, Missouri, Maine, Alaska. There's a number of other states out there with similar statutes. Some, of course, use their professional rules as suggested by the bar. Although they rely on a different section of the rules, they rely on the one that our court rejected, which was, sub D of the old model rules, which said any conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. Nonpayment has been dealt with by some Supreme Courts under that section. I think Alabama uses that in particular.
Counsel, are you familiar, and it's okay if you're not, with the Nugent case?
The recent non-filing case?
The reason I ask that is because it came out from this court on October 10th, 2006.
Yes,
now, if you're like me, if it's a year old, the answer is clearly no. If it's in the same month, maybe. So that's why I ask if you're familiar with that case, since it involves the Department of Revenue's action also, as I understand it.
Yes, I did review that case before coming to the
court. Now, in that case, we disciplined for failure to timely file personal state income tax returns for the years 1996 to 2001. And the Wisconsin Department of Revenue issued estimated assessments for those years in the amount of lots of money, $171,000. We also disciplined because there was the non-payment of corporate income tax returns, as I understand, as I recall. And the opinion says that he had not timely filed his corporate income tax returns. With regard to corporate income tax returns, how does that information get transmitted? Or how did, and he didn't file his personal tax returns. Does, without this proposal that you have here before, I mean, how does the OLR divine that corporate tax returns haven't been timely filed? What's the current working relationship and transmitting of information between your department and OLR?
We do have, one of my attorneys links up with OLR and reviews cases before they're referred to OLR to make sure that they're suitable for referral, that we've done everything possible, we've made everything, every effort possible to resolve it. And then they pass the information to OLR, as I understand it.
And when you say you've done everything, earlier in your presentation you went through all the checks that you go through or, under this proposed rule. If there's failure to pay, you said we'd give them notice and then we'd try to get cooperation. And if that doesn't work, then we'd do collection efforts. And if that doesn't work, certification. That was
right.
The kind of...
Right.
Other than certification, is that the kind of regimen that currently exists or existed in the Nugent case, and that is that if there's a failure to timely file, that you give them notice and then you try to get cooperation, and if that doesn't work, then you try to get them to file and pay, and if that doesn't work, then it's referred to the OLR?
Yes, we would essentially, we try to exhaust all remedies internally first. Frankly, we don't want to send you anything but our strongest cases.
What if under this proposed rule you had the same kind of fact scenario with regard to Attorney Nugent that we had this month? What would you do about the corporate income tax non-filing? Would that be, that wouldn't be certified?
I believe I said that income sales and withholding, perhaps I didn't say this correctly, are the most common. I mean, those are generally the most common. Corporate franchise is fairly rare because not that many law firms are set up that way. I mean, by the bulk is sole practitioners. And also, we have to go through responsible person litigation to establish who is responsible in the law firm for payment of taxes. And a corporate franchise tax, it's quite uncommon, as I understand it, for those to be brought. But I imagine they still would be.
In light of the arrangement you have with OLR now, why do you need anything else?
Because, Your Honor, it's not clear in the rules as they stand that non-payment is grounds for discipline and or
maybe
suspension.
Grounds.
But,
as
yes,
the petition is drafted.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Erlinson. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear on this proceeding? Let me, before I close our hearings, welcome visitors from Japan who are here with us today for signing a sister city agreement this evening. Perhaps our guests would stand and tell us which are the two cities, if you would. In my limited Japanese, I'll say konnichiwa. And welcome. Domo arigato gozaimasu. Thank you for coming. I have now exhausted all of my Japanese, which is tourist Japanese. Ma'am? How do you do, Mr. Mayor? Good seeing you. I've been to Hokkaido, but not to your city. It is very beautiful, and the area reminds me very much of Wisconsin. It does. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. I'm now going to close our hearing on 0605 in the matter of the petition for adoption of a procedure to suspend or deny the license to practice law of a person certified as delinquent in payment of Wisconsin state taxes. The court will, these hearings are now adjourned. The court will appear and discuss each of these petitions in turn, and we hope we can reach a decision on each of them. The hearing is adjourned.